This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Welcome to the Lannan Foundation in Pursuit of Cultural Freedom. Our distinguished guest this evening is Barbara Ehrenreich, one of America's finest essayists and social critics. I'm David Barsamian. After the program concludes, there'll be a book signing in the lobby. And a special shout out to students from the master's program at Santa Fe Community College who are joining us this evening. The future writers and social critics of this country. Remember the boundless energy and can-do optimism of Ethel Merman belting out Everything's Coming Up Roses from the 1950s Broadway hit Gypsy? Is anyone old enough here to remember that? Curtain up, light the lights. We got nothing to hit but the heights. You'll be swell, you'll be great. Gonna have the whole world on a plate. Starting here, starting now. Everything's coming up roses for you and for me. Well, that was another United States, romanticized for sure. We live in another country now. Breaking news. More than 50 million Americans live in poverty, which does not include the untold numbers not on the grid. We see them on our sidewalks, in our parks, under bridges, and in post office lobbies. As Barbara Ehrenreich reminds us in her book, This Land is Their Land, in a process that began in the 1980s and suddenly accelerated in the early 2000s, the ground was shifting under our feet, recarving the American landscape. The peaks of great wealth grew higher, rising up beyond the clouds, while the valleys of poverty sank lower into perpetual shadow. The once broad plateau of the middle class eroded away into a narrow ledge with the white-knuckled occupants holding on to dear life. On the other end, she writes, freshly fattened CEOs, hedge fund operators, and financiers slugged back $10,000 martinis at the Algonquin Hotel in New York and staged a multi-million dollar birthday party featuring an ice statue of David urinating vodka. Barbara Ehrenreich is, as one reviewer wrote, our premier reporter on the underside of capitalism. Her work resonates and echoes with the muckrakers and great investigative journalists of the past, such as Upton Sinclair, Lincoln Steffens, and Ida B. Tarbell. She gets dirt under her fingernails. In her classic book, Nickel and Dime, which has sold 1.5 million copies and is still selling, she works as a waitress, hotel maid, house cleaner, nursing home aide, and Walmart associate, chronicling not only her own struggles, but crucially those of her fellow workers, who are often just economic statistics and lines in graphs. Bill Moyer says Nickel and Dimed is the most important book on American life since Michael Harrington's The Other America. I would, he says, make Nickel and Dime required reading for the White House staff. Then he adds, Barbara Ehrenreich reminds us, there are things to get mad at. In her book, Bait and Switch, she goes undercover again, as she did in Nickel and Dime, exploring the white-collar unemployed. She attends job fairs, networking events, and evangelical job search ministries. She is proselytized, scammed, lectured, and again rejected. In the afterword of the book, there are some very heartbreaking testimonies from those who are looking futilely for work. And you can read them on her website, BarbaraEhrenreich.com. The once heralded war on poverty has morphed into a war on the poor. Poverty is being criminalized. And I can think of no other writer than Barbara Ehrenreich, who has written with such eloquence, focused rage, and compassion on poverty, race, class, and gender issues, and the economic system, which is producing more and more inequality. Please give a warm New Mexico welcome to Barbara Ehrenreich.
Hey. Hi. Thank you. Thank you. Actually, these lights right on me, could they be dimmed? I mean, you don't need to see me, do you? Maybe we could just tone those down. Okay. I am so glad to be in Santa Fe. For me, Santa Fe is like Mecca. I mean, it's like a very special holy place because of your minimum wage. Last week, that's what brought me here in 2007, 6 years ago, the minimum wage campaign, and I know there are people here from it who are here tonight, but I was looking so much forward to coming here because last week I gave a talk at George Mason University in Virginia, and as usual in these situations, a student in the audience stood up in a Q&A and said that she had learned in her economics class that raising the minimum wage would cause widespread unemployment and economic ruin. Now, I hear this every time I speak on a campus, and I think that academic economics departments are dedicated to one proposition only, and that is teaching that the economic status quo is exactly fine, and it's perfect even for the poor. So I said to this young woman, I said, will you come with me to Santa Fe next week? Come and see for yourself. This is the highest minimum wage city of, well, I think you're only outdone by San Francisco. I'm not sure. But I think you are, it's San Francisco, Santa Fe, that's it. When I came here 6 years ago, so I have a comparison because it was 6 years ago, and I am not seeing boarded up businesses. I am not seeing a city brought to its knees by the raised minimum wage. Now, last time I came here, and right to this theater, in fact, I spoke entirely about my book, Nickel and Dimed. I'm going to talk about that a little bit. I'm going to look back at that a little bit, and also talk about things that I have been learning from much more recent research since the economic downturn. My starting point for a lot of this, I will tell you, it's sort of the source of a lot of my motivation, is I get really, really upset whenever I hear someone speak disrespectfully about people in poverty, and maybe especially women in poverty. And I have personal reasons for that reaction. But, you know, in the 1990s, I was hearing a lot of that kind of disrespect, especially from politicians and pundits. There's something wrong with poor people. That was a theory, and in many quarters, it still is. Poor people have low IQs. We've had Charles Murray to point that out, as well as people of color having lower IQs, he pointed out. They have character defects. They make bad lifestyle decisions. Poor women are promiscuous. They are lazy. They have too many children. They don't bother to get married. They eat too many Doritos and drink too much Mountain Dew. That is pretty much, been the official theory of poverty in America, which is if people are poor, they have nobody but to blame but themselves. And, you know, this works its way into policy all the time. For example, the original welfare reform bill, which was in 1996, the bill that ended welfare as we knew it, ended any kind of entitlement of poor single parents to any kind of government aid or to as an entitlement to government aid. So this bill provided in it originally $100 million for chastity training for low-income women. That's the theory. That's the theory, right? So imagine the scene. Bill Clinton signing into law, you know, this provision for chastity training, not unfortunately for himself, but anyway, You know, and that amount went up as of the most recent amount. It was up to $400 million for training poor women to make them more marriageable. You know, a lot, you know, some of us ladies aren't married because we haven't tried. We really need the education. Actually, I've tried it a number of times. And I don't know. You know, it seemed to me that the problem had nothing to do with lifestyles or personal choices, or that overwhelmingly it has nothing to do with those things. I started my, I guess, campaign on the living, my own personal crusade for a living wage, just by reading my local newspaper, seeing what wages were being offered in the Help Wanted ads, and they're very cleverly don't mention them usually, then turned to the apartment rental section and see what the rents are. And the math did not look good to me. That was my starting point. And I agonized about this so much and complained about it so much I finally got a magazine editor to say, Barbara, what you have to do is go out there and try living on these wages yourself. I had meant somebody should do it. I did not mean myself as a journalist. But journalists need what jobs they can get and what assignments they could get. So I had to leave home. I had to find the cheapest accommodations possible. And I was not trying to find the lowest wage jobs I could. I was not trying to find minimum wage jobs. I had to find, my rule for myself was I had to find the best paying jobs I could, consistent with not using my actual resume or, you know, educational experience or anything. Not, though, that I could have cheated very easily because I never did see a Help Wanted ad for a political essayist. And in particular, I never saw a Help Wanted ad for a sarcastic feminist political essayist. David, in his wonderful introduction, told you what jobs I ended up getting, like waitress and hotel housekeeper. That's where I fit in the labor market. That's what I found. It had been a while since I had worked in any of these kinds of jobs, since I was a teenager. And one of the first things that struck me about being in the low-wage workforce, and this has not changed a little bit, and not at all, since 2000, is the constant suspicion that if you're willing to work for those wages, you probably have some sort of criminal tendencies. There's something wrong with you, right? The drug test. Anybody here ever take a drug test to get a job? Oh, how'd you do? Good. No, we'll talk about that later. Then there's the personality test. Most of the questions are, I thought, being kind of a smart aleck, I thought that was pretty easy. Like, here's an example, and I wrote this one down, so it's word for word. You get this in your application process. Quote, in the last year I have stolen, parentheses, check dollar amount below, worth of goods from my employers, close quote. And you see that, and you really want to be a smart aleck and say, do you have a calculator I could use? Yeah. Or then there was, this question, which pops up on many companies' tests for their low-wage workers. Agree or disagree, it is easier to work when you're a little bit high. You don't want to overthink that one, It'd be so easy to get philosophical there, but don't do it. That's the preparation. Then you enter into a job paying, at the time I was doing this, I averaged $7 an hour. And these were hard jobs, all the jobs I had. They were physically hard jobs. And I would have to say that's one argument for doing this sort of journalism, which is called immersion journalism, where you actually put your body into it. And that is that if you ask people, is your job physically hard? Oh, they'll say, yeah, but most people don't complain a lot. It was another thing to do it myself. I'm strong. I'm fit. But there were many jobs where after a shift, my legs would feel like rubber. So, you know, that had to find that out. A more important thing, I think, is that I picked up about how hard these jobs were is something that was completely surprising to me. I'm educated. I've written a lot of books, as David told you. These jobs were mentally challenging. Every one of them, I had a hard time learning. And it's a humbling kind of discovery. I'll just mention one example of that, which was at Walmart. I was assigned to ladies' wear. I thought, oh, great. I'll be giving fashion advice to the women of Minnesota. No. The main thing was picking up garments from the floor or that things that had been hidden for some mysterious reason that I don't know what consumers are thinking, but in the wrong department. Somebody has to find everything and put it in its exact right place. In other words, I had to memorize the exact location of hundreds of different items, which would then be rotated every few days for no other purpose than to convince me I have Alzheimer's disease. Why Walmart wanted to do that, I don't know, but that was the plan. So very important lesson for me here. I never use the word unskilled to describe anybody's job. Every job, every person's job, takes intelligence and skill and concentration and deserves our complete respect. You know, that's... Now, some of these jobs were also a lot harder than they needed to be because of absurd management rules, like no talking to your fellow employees. You can guess why that is. No drinking water, even in a sweaty job. And then there's a whole bathroom break situation. I was in some of those jobs, the bathroom breaks were so rare, I looked back on the drug test with nostalgia. You know? They don't tell you that could be the last time. There is an academic book that's been written about bathroom breaks in the United States workforce. The title tells it all. It's called Void Where Prohibited. And then an interesting thing, you know, in all these jobs, they suspect you of stealing. They're all, you know, that you might, that your purse could be searched at any point because you might be stealing, ketchup packets from the restaurant or something. However, in most of these jobs, it's management that's stealing. Wage theft is a huge problem in America. I could see it going on, but I didn't even have a term for it when I was doing these jobs. It's something like being, one form it can take is, Walmart just changes the computers so it doesn't look like you've worked so long or so many hours. Another thing is they can tell you to come in a half an hour before the clock starts ticking for your pay, and you start working, and they're not paying you for that. To me, this is really something, the amounts of this. I pressed the experts on this to come up with an estimate of the amount that is stolen from low-wage workers in America in the form of wage theft. The number they came up with for me was $106 billion a year. $106 billion is on the order of magnitude of some of our larger social programs. Bigger, I think, than unemployment insurance. Anyway, I had a lot of trouble making ends meet. I had no idea how out of whack wages and rents were going to be. And obviously, I was looking at the cheapest places to stay in, which included trailer parks. And very often, these places called residential motels that you can get into without 1 month's rent deposit or anything. You pay by the week. And I learned a very important thing in these living situations. It's expensive to be poor. If you don't have that 1 month's rent and security deposit up front, which would be more than $1,000, a lot of capital, Then you're stuck with outrageous weekly payments. In this one residential motel I ended up at, it was $250 a week to stay in an absolute dump that smelled like rodent droppings, and it had no fridge or microwave, meaning that everything I bought to eat had to come from a convenience store, and occasionally as a treat, fast food. So right away, I'm not complaining about the cuisine, it's just right away, that's a lot more expensive than being able to go to a grocery store. So, the rent, the expenses, I ultimately realized this is not possible. I would have to, find a lot of roommates or something. And I had advantages, like not having children with me. I tried to get my children to come with me, but at a certain point. How you do this sort of thing? If you are, say, suppose I was a single parent with one child trying to do the same thing. You can do the math here. In New Mexico, the minimum wage for the state is $7.50 an hour, which is ahead of the federal amount. But a living wage calculated by the Massachusetts Institute for Technology for this state for one adult, one child, is $17.78 an hour. Way off. In Santa Fe, due to a heroic, exemplary struggle, you have a minimum wage that begins to somewhat more closely approach what people might need to live on, $10.50 an hour. But a sad news here, a living wage for Santa Fe, according to MIT, would be $19.82 an hour. And that's for a bare-bones existence. There's no internet in there. There's no movies. There's no vacations. Now, sometimes affluent people say to me, why don't these people just learn how to manage their finances a little bit better? And there's a growing movement, a crusade, sort of, to provide financial literacy training for poor people. What bothers me so much about this is that if you're trying to live on $7, $8, $9, $10 an hour, there's only one financial plan for you, and it's called just say no. Don't buy it. Don't eat it. Don't drink it. Don't smoke it. Don't fix it if it breaks. Don't go to a doctor in the first place. And you know, I just found out recently due to some recent research that who's funding financial literacy education in our public schools? The banks. Wells Fargo, Capital One. The same banks that brought us the mortgage crisis in the middle of the 00s. The banks that have depended on the gullibility and ignorance and trust of consumers all along. So, we have a lot of full-time workers in this country who don't make enough to live on, if you're talking about living indoors, that is. Homeless people who are full-time workers. I met them, I'm sure you know some of them. Even more disturbing to me, in some way, hungry workers. Now, those were some of the things, that's sort of an image of when in the early 00s, before the economic downturn. What I described in the book Nickel and Diamond, in case any of you have been forced to read it in school or something, is out of date, because those were the good old days. Everything you read in there, you have to correct and say, what would this be like today? When it's so much harder to find these jobs, and when in many ways wages and conditions have deteriorated. And what happened in the last 4 years or so of downturn? The number of people in poverty grew to over 15.5% of Americans. And a large part of this increase, I can't tell you how much, I wish I knew, is not people who were poor necessarily in the long term, or people whose parents were also poor, but people who had higher educations, who have higher, who have degrees, people who were lawyers, IT experts, college graduates of all kinds. These are not the kind of people that stereotype I talked about at the beginning can apply to. These are not the people who have the bad lifestyles, so-called. They got poor, you know, because they didn't have money. In fact, that's become a sort of a major kind of theoretical breakthrough of mine, that the cause of poverty may not be character failings, may not even be lack of education, may not be bad habits. The real core of poverty is a shortage of money. That's it, you know. It's a theoretical breakthrough. I'm trying to push it. So generally when we talk about doing something about poverty, we talk about things that need to be done. Affordable housing, subsidized child care, all those sorts of things. We talk about budgets, programs. This afternoon I went to a fascinating meeting put together by HomeWise, the housing organization in Santa Fe, to talk about just this kind of thing. How do we build programs and make them work effectively to help people move up? The sad truth in this country now, though, is instead of helping the down and out, we have a society that seems to persecute the poor, so that if you start sliding downhill, you're likely to accelerate all the way into destitution, or even further. And there is another step, and that's incarceration. This is something that has accelerated and increased since the middle of the 00s. And I'll tell you why I think that is. This sort of persecution of the poor. Both government and corporations play a role in this. First of all, a number of employers openly discriminate against hiring unemployed people. I mean, this is it's funny to say that. They don't want to hire unemployed people. They want to hire people who already have jobs. Why is that? Because the same stereotypes that apply to the poor apply to the unemployed. They must be losers. So don't hire them. In fact, there are states now that have been trying to pass laws so that you can't have help wanted ads that say, for example, no unemployed candidates will be considered at all, close quote. More and more employers, and I've seen numbers that go up to 70%, now do a credit check on people who apply for a job. So right there. I mean, it's nothing to do with your ability to perform the job. But right there, the people who most desperately need employment are weeded out. and if you've been relying on credit cards to get through these things, you know, the poor face higher interest rates. They don't get regular credit cards. They get subprime credit cards. I won't even talk about payday lenders because there's such astronomical amounts of interest. And if you think you could get rid of any of these bills by filing for bankruptcy, I was shocked to find that the average cost of filing for bankruptcy in America is $2,000. And where are you going to get the $2,000 just to become bankrupt? Do we need a special program for that? Bankruptcy assistance? Now, here's the most sinister thing to me, though. And a lot of this is research I've done and reporting I've done, but also because I work now with a group called the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, which I am proud to say I launched, but we get starving journalists who are pretty easy to find to do really good research on these sorts of issues. And the most sinister thing, it seems to me, is the ways in which government contributes its own harassment of the poor. 10 million people are charged each year in this country with misdemeanors. Many of these are very minor misdemeanors. I'll mention some of them. But they still lead to fines and even jail time. 75% of the people charged with misdemeanors, this is kind of interesting, are indigent. And the average fine for a misdemeanor is in the range of $200 to $500. So you take the, well, let's give you some examples of what the things you can do. You're already poor, right? You've got a low-wage job. In New York, it is illegal to put your foot, feet up on a subway seat that is empty. The whole subway car can be empty. It can be 3 in the morning. You're returning from your dishwashing job. You put your feet up, and a cop comes in. You are not warned. You are not reprimanded. You don't receive a citation. You are arrested. You're right then taken off the subway train and into a police station. And so the next thing is, you're going to be charged. You're going to have court costs because now the defendant is charged with all the court costs, or increasingly with the court costs. In Washington, D.C., you can be arrested, not just warned or given a citation for driving with an expired license. And so you can see how this grows. The example I like to give is if you're driving with a broken headlight, it could cost $150 maybe to get a new one put in. You don't have $150. You've got to get to work or from work or whatever. And you get stopped for that. You get fined $200. Well, if you had that money, you would have fixed the headlight, right? So you can't pay that. Then the court is going to issue a summons at some point because you haven't paid, that kind of cost. The summons is going to be turned over to a collection agent, which may not bother even getting your correct address. Most people who are issued summonses don't show up and say they never got the summons. That's now called failure to appear. Now you're in real trouble. Now there's a warrant out for your arrest, and the likelihood is you have no idea about that. Another thing that is in the public sector realm is a growing number of cities have taken to ticketing and sometimes handcuffing children found on the streets during school hours. In Los Angeles, the fine for truancy is $250. In Dallas, it can be as high as $500, crushing amounts for people who don't have much money. In New Mexico, when there's a second conviction for a child's truancy, a parent may face a fine of not more than $500 or imprisonment for up to 6 months. Now, we want children to go to school, right? But in L.A., some community groups studied the situation because, people were getting afraid to send their children to school in case they were a little bit late and got caught in the street and these fines started piling up on the family. So the community organizations found out that 80% of the so-called truants were simply late for school because a city bus was too full and whizzed right by their school bus stop so they couldn't get to school on time. I know sometimes it sounds good. Let's really get those kids in school. Let's get the parent, make the parents responsible. This has become an additional way of criminalizing the poor. It is not in L.A. the kids in Beverly Hills who are getting whose families are getting tickets for this. Now, this sort of police harassment has increased since the recession started, as far as anybody can tell me, because it looks like it's a way for municipalities and counties to raise their revenues. They're really pressed for revenues, so they said, let's have more infractions. Let's have higher fines. Let's charge our court costs. What happens if you don't pay a fine? Well, you may go to jail. There's a case I found pretty fascinating about a South Carolina woman who was trying to make a living, post losing her business in the recession, by selling plasma, her own blood, and also scrap metal. She was found in January 2012, She was charged with having a, quote, messy yard. Who knew that was a crime? Fined $480. Of course she didn't have $480. So she was jailed for 6 days until there was a community protest to get her out. At least in this case, she was not charged room and board for her jail time. And if that sounds, you know, this is something I really want to know more about this. I have no national numbers on this. I just know it's increasingly frequent to be charged room and board for your jail time, just as like for your court costs. I want the money to do the kind of investigation, not me, I'll get other people, smarter people to do it, to find out just how frequent is that now? Because why are people in jail in the first place usually? Well, you may say they've done something wrong, but also because they are too poor to have private representation in court or anything else. They're poor. So you jail them and then they come out and you say, oh, that'll be $60 a day for your stay here. It's very easy, to get in deep trouble quickly. The story that I find most amazing is comes from Michigan in 2009. It's of a woman. I should mention this is actually a white woman. If this story sounds if it sounds like all this is racial profiling, it is not. Always, a homeless woman, a full-time worker, was arrested, as a homeless person. When they got her, they found she had an even worse thing on her record than being homeless, and that is her 16-year-old son was in jail, and she was not keeping up with his room and board charges. So she was jailed because of that. So you have that two family members, caught in this situation. Fortunately, the ACLU intervened in her case. One of the things that's proliferated since economic downturn is laws that forbid and outlaw, essentially, homelessness. In a good example would be, a particularly evil one would be from Sarasota, Florida, which passed an ordinance that it is illegal there to be asleep outdoors and, quote, when awakened, state that he or she has no other place to live, close quote. In other words, if you're sleeping in a park and a police officer comes over and says, and shakes you awake and you say, oh, I just didn't feel like staying in my penthouse condo tonight. I really needed a change. Fine, that's legal. But if you waken and you say, oh, I've got nowhere to go, that is a crime. Now think about that. There are no laws, of course, that require cities to provide food, shelter, or restrooms for their indigent citizens. Restrooms, big issue. Public urination is a crime almost everywhere. But is anybody going to help you to do it unpublicly? If you don't have the money or the skin color or whatever it takes to walk into a restaurant and sort of just use the facilities. I think the worst part of this is that in some cities such as Orlando, it is even illegal to help the poor. There are laws forbidding the sharing of food with indigent people in public places. And there's a great group, Food Not Bombs. You might have heard of them. And they like to get in those parks and serve vegan food to homeless people. And I don't hold the vegan part against them, but, that's great. But very sweet, nice, middle-class people have spent time in jail for that crime. Now, as far as I'm concerned, that is like outlawing Christianity or outlawing ethics or something. And how do they define indigent? Well, I don't know how the word definition exactly in Orlando, but Las Vegas had a great definition of indigent, and that was that an indigent person is someone whom a reasonable person would consider to be eligible for public assistance or able to apply for public assistance. Now, that could have been, that could be me in my everyday work outfit, you know, at home as a freelance writer. But that's the depth of prejudice there, you know, it's incomprehensible. So we have a pattern in this country. We have been defunding services that might help the poor while ramping up various forms of harassment of the poor, including a law enforcement. So you starve school budgets, for example. You cut all the fun things like art and drama and everything, and then make truancy illegal. You cut public transportation budgets and make it lateness to school illegal. Shut down public housing and then make it a crime to be homeless. And, you know, at a time of high unemployment in most parts of this country, make it more and more difficult for people who are unemployed, who need jobs, to find them. Now, it's clear, you know, the positive kinds of things we need to do in this country. You know, we need affordable housing. We need to raise the minimum wage everywhere. And that's where, you know, you, in Santa Fe, you have to go out there and be the missionaries around the country so you can raise the minimum wage and have a better, stronger community. You could cut, executive compensation at the top of the corporate hierarchy. You just want to keep things in line. You know, it's amazing how some of the same economic conservatives who will say, no, we cannot raise the minimum wage, say, well, how about controlling executive compensation? Oh, no, they do that either. Why not? Why not bring that down? We've got health reform, or we should shortly have it, and New Mexico, the question will be whether it is actually implemented so that people can sign up for expanded Medicaid. What about some sick days for this country? Nearly half of America's private sector workers have no guaranteed paid, no guaranteed sick days, and can face firing for staying home with a sick child. You know, I could go on and on and on with, you know, with the things that need to be done. I'll mention this since there are college students in the audience. You know, this isn't working, this higher education business. It is not working anymore. You have no guarantee of a job when you get out. What you have is a guarantee of a huge debt. And an awful lot of poor students are trying to get through college now while working full-time, which is not possible. No one should have to go through this. No one should graduate with tens of thousands of dollars in debt. In fact, I'm for an immediate debt jubilee for all those student loans. But, you know, I'm not pushing a positive agenda here. We all know what it is. My sort of short-term demand is much more modest. Could we just stop the meanness? Could we stop the relentless persecution of people who are already having a hard time? Could we stop the wage theft by employers? Could we stop treating low-wage workers as criminals? Give them some rights in the workplace so they could even organize into unions if they want to? Stop penalizing people for their credit scores. Since when is a credit score is a measure of a person's worth, which is how we act about that today? Could we stop harassing the homeless and the indigent as if, you know, in a sense, to be homeless, to be indigent in America, you have entered the ranks of a population very little different from undocumented workers. It's like you're not a citizen anymore. It's like you have no rights at all here. In other words, Could we stop kicking people when they're down? That's my program. Not my whole one, but I don't think this is about, you know, any sort of like, you know, whether you're a liberal or a conservative or what's your religious orientation or anything. I think these are moral issues. How we treat the people who are in need is a moral issue. And I want to quote someone who was here tonight, Carol Oppenheimer. Where are you? Where are you? No, oh, there she is. I think she's back there. Who was one of the people who was one of the original activists around raising about the minimum wage in Santa Fe. And I remember reading her quoted in the New York Times in 2006. And this quote, it really meant a lot to me. She said, "What really got the other side," and she's talking about the opponents of raising the minimum wage, "was when we said, it's just immoral to pay people $5.15 an hour. They can't live on that." She said, when we said that, it made some of these business people furious. So we kept saying it over and over again. Forget the so-called economic argument. This is a moral argument. And, you know, I tell, when I speak to religious audiences, and I sometimes do, you know, if you're looking for some kind of biblical backup, you know, you're not going to find a lot on abortion in the Bible. You're not going to find anything on gay marriage in the Bible. You're not going to find a word about stem cell research in the Bible. But you will find 3,000 references to the moral claim that people who are hurting, chiefly because of poverty, have on the rest of us. And I think it is time to start acting on that moral imperative and maybe even get to the point where we move on from stop kicking people when they're down to the point where we're actually constantly reaching out a hand. Thank you. Thanks.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Well, that was a lot of fun. And I mean, it's hard to talk about humor and these issues in the same breath, but a lot of what you do reminds me of the work of Howard Zinn, who did combine a great sense of humor while talking about very serious issues. I'd like you to talk about what's happened to the Democratic Party over the decades. In relation to issues of class, particularly, and poverty. And I'm reminded of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, no radical, but in his 1944 State of the Union address that he delivered on economic justice, he had a whole list of things that he said that America must do and guarantee, for example, the right to a useful and remunerative job, not just any job, but mm-hmm. one that is remunerative, the right to earn enough to provide adequate food, clothing, and recreation, the right of every family to a decent home, the right to adequate medical care and the opportunity to achieve and enjoy good health, the right to adequate protection from the economic fears of old age, sickness, accident, and unemployment, and the right to a good education. He said, all of these rights spell security.
He was a socialist. I mean, I told you, David, I really cannot comment a lot on our elected officials or our Democratic Party. I would just point out that it was good to hear Obama talking recently about raising the federal minimum wage to $9 an hour until you realize that when he was running for office, he was saying $9.50. When he was running for re-election, he was saying $9.50 an hour. If he keeps going down at that rate, we'll be, you know, the national is, what, $7.25 an hour?
Yeah, but still, if you were working at, let's say it's, you know, Congress passes it at $9 or $9.50, that's still, if you're working full-time, you are in poverty.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. No, no question about that.
Well, you have a background with Democratic Socialists, and you kind of didn't answer the question about what has happened. Sorry, to the politics in this country, where the plight of the poor was once a focus. There was an announced war on poverty in America.
Well, I don't look at it so much politically, and you can fill in and you can answer your own question part ways. But, is it in the early 60s, this culture of poverty idea took hold, which is what I was talking about is terrible stereotypes about the poverty, about the poor, that there's something wrong with them that has to be fixed. Not that there's something wrong with wages, that there's a lack of housing, and so on. And that's what I think has to be turned around. Now, I think there are obvious things everybody's probably thinking of right now, like, well, campaign finance, the obvious dependence of elected officials on great wealth, which I don't know the solution to, as long as they're, unless we prevent all advertising for candidates, which might not be a bad idea.
How has the decline in the union movement affected this issue of wages and poverty?
It's a disaster. The unions, have been pushing for raising the minimum wage. That's a good thing. I fault them for spending the last 5 or so years without doing a huge effort to organize the unemployed. I mean, just so many people have lost their jobs in this country in waves. I've met with mill workers in Maine and foundry workers in Indiana. And when you lose your job, you lose your union membership. No, that's exactly where the union should be in, fighting for you harder than ever. I am quite critical of some of our major unions. I mean, I'll say something which may get me in a lot of trouble back in D.C., but I think they have to sell off their real estate. Who's visited Washington, D.C., and seen the beautiful buildings that the Teamsters, the AFL-CIO, et cetera, even the SEIU, occupy? I think all that has to go. It's probably worth hundreds of millions, billions of dollars, and all that has to be turned over into grassroots organizing. Really, that's the only thing to do with that.
Well, union membership is now at almost 100-year low, and there's been concerted attacks and well-documented in Ohio, Wisconsin, Michigan, to take away collective bargaining.
Mm-hmm.
But talk about their endorsement of Keystone XL, the pipeline project that would bring tar sands.
Well, they didn't come right out and endorse the Keystone pipeline, right? They just said there's a lot of good stuff about pipelines, right? You know better. You obviously follow this better than I do. I found very shocking about that in a statement from the AFL-CIO. But at the same time, they're saying we, the unions, have to be sort of a nexus of democratic forces in this country. And they included, civil rights, women, et cetera. And they suddenly dropped the environmental movement? What was that with that? If you're not, I spend a lot of time backing union organizing drives, walking picket lines, and right now, I always try to remind workers, they have the option of forming their own associations. You do not have to be part of any sort of national or international labor movement, union, to be organized. The flight, like the American Airlines flight attendants, they're not part of the AFL-CIO. They have their own association. the clerical workers at the University of California, at least in Berkeley, own association. That's another way we have to think of that people can go.
The economist Richard Wolff on this stage talked about the systemic and structural problems of capitalism that need to be addressed rather than this or that particular problem. What do you think about that?
I tend to think smaller. I tend to think of, in my actual work. Yes, I agree with Richard Wolff, I agree, obviously. But, we have to break things down into a size we can deal with. In Santa Fe, 6-7 years ago when the living wage movement started, they could have said, well, obviously we have to smash capitalism. That's what's wrong here, right? Some people getting rich off of other people. Right, that would be true at some level. But they also carved out an attack. Now, if you want to call that reformism, then we have a fight, David, and I was hoping we'd have a fight.
New Mexico is also a state with not just a large number of poor, but of the people in poverty, many of them are Native Americans. And Nicholas Kristof had a piece in the Times a few months back called Poverty's Poster Child, where he talks about the levels of poverty, particularly on the reservations in South Dakota. How has this issue, the economic issue, specifically impacted Native Americans?
Fill us in. Say more. David, don't...
In a very negative way.
Yeah. I mean, thank you. In a very negative way. No, but I mean, you want to fill that in a little more?
Well, four or five of the poorest counties in the United States are on Indian land. And there's a tremendous concentration of poverty, unemployment, dysfunctional domestic life, violence, crime, all of these other indices that we're always regaled with when talking about them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and I would just add one other thing. Did I mention the Economic Hardship Reporting Project?
You did.
Okay, this is my project. We're trying to get starving journalists to write about economic hardship. And we had a very good piece a few months ago, which we got out in a variety of media, about what's happening on Native American reservations in North Dakota. North Dakota, that's the big oil boom state. And so they get jobs, the frackers come in, and everybody gets a job. However, at the same time, the place they're in becomes unlivable because of, giant trucks going on. There is actually no housing. Our reporter lived in a parking lot in her car, in a rental car, in the Walmart parking lot. Everything just went to hell. So, that sort of shows another side. You can have economic development, so-called, that is also social collapse.
I was reminded of this Yeats couplet when you were talking about meanness and kind of the hardening of the emotional arteries in the body politic. He said, "We have fed the heart on fantasies. The heart has grown brutal on the fair." How do we stop that meanness?
That what?
The meanness.
Meanness. Well, you see, it's not meanness in us each individually. I think very few of us have an impulse when we see a panhandler to hit the person or something or call the police. But it becomes systematic. When your municipality is so starved for finances that they think that's actually a good way to make money by laying more fines and fees on top of the poorest people, that then it becomes organized. And then we can do something. A lot of that is within reach of city ordinances, of people. You want children handcuffed on the streets for being late to school? You got a choice. You can vote on that and go to city council on that. And so you have to, you know, but it means looking at all those places where the gears are turning in that kind of direction and intervening.
Well, I'm sure glad that truancy thing wasn't in force when I was going to junior high school and high school, because I was playing hooky most of the time and my immigrant parents would have probably landed in debtor's prison or something. If it existed at the time.
Debtor's prison does now exist.
De facto, yeah?
No. I mean, well, yes. Or de jure, whatever. I mean, and I tried to sketch out the way that can happen. If you miss a court summons, you have a debt, and and it could be the private sector debt. It could be that you didn't pay your rent, and your landlord decides to take you to court over that. You don't show up because you don't get the summons, or you have to work at that time, or you have no vehicle or whatever, then you are a criminal.
One of the characteristics of the ongoing Great Recession, which is also has noted just in recent weeks, the stock market has hit record highs once again, but people don't seem to be doing as well as Wall Street. One of the characteristics is long-term chronic unemployment. That's defined by the Labor Department as 27 weeks or more of people being out of work. And it turns out that most of these people are elderly. I mean, they're over 60. And it's very, very hard for them to get back into the job market. So could you... What
well,
role does ageism...
Yeah. I mean, about 45... I'm thinking now
point.
At the white-collar, sort of professional, managerial job market. And I investigated for my book, Bait and Switch, which was really hard. You think nickel and dime was hard? This was really hard. And because all the advice is, on your resume, include no experience that goes back more than 10 years. Because that'll give your age away. See, so, you know, there are no jobs after a certain age. And I think one of the scariest times of life for people, no matter how educated or successful they might have been at some point, is when you become too old to be employable again. Say you're 52 and you want to go back into being some kind of, you know, practicing your white-collar profession. But you're too young to qualify for Social Security or Medicare. That's a very scary little period in there when you become unemployable and you don't qualify for those limited benefits.
But what does it say about the economic system when there's obviously so much work to be done, so much infrastructure that needs to be built and repaired and restored on one side? And on the other side, you have all of these people out of work that are looking for work, but this system can't bring them together.
You're indicting capitalism again.
Again.
Again, yeah. No, sure. I mean, it's like, is there any shortage of things to do in this country? And it's not just physical infrastructure. It's also what you could call human or social infrastructure. The baby boomers, more and more, are going to need home health care aides, just to give one example. If you're not all going to be in nursing homes, we're going to need that kind of service. Right now, home health care aides are treated terribly. They're paid near the minimum wage everywhere. They have, you know, they have no more rights than the average domestic worker. We're not putting the need together with the ability to do something about that. We have so many children who are, they need tutoring. They need help with school. They need smaller classrooms. And then we have all these unemployed teachers. No, it's an economy like that has to be changed.
You write that there was no decision to become a writer. That was something I just started doing. And incidentally, Barbara has an extensive background in science. You have your PhD in cell biology. How did you become a writer?
I never thought about it as a profession. When I decided to become, quote, socially relevant, those were the old term, and went to work with a little group of young activists in New York City, working in the around 1970 around getting great, improving health care for low-income people in New York City. I actually had no thought of any kind of career. I got my PhD in cell biology, I threw that over, or just got tired of the bench. And then in my first little movement job, I found myself doing a lot of writing. And I liked it, and I liked doing investigations, too, because that seemed to come straight from science.
And in Nickel and Dimed and Bait and Switch, you really foreground the first-person narrative. You're the actor there, interacting in these different situations. Very different from rather distant political analysis and essays.
Yeah, it was strange. Very strange.
Well, you did say that something that prepared you for writing was the amount of reading that you used to do. You were a big reader.
Oh, yes. And sometimes, students ask me, how can I become a writer? Or not just students. Everybody, writing seems very glamorous. It is glamorous. It's wonderful. There's just no pay. But other than that. I'll say to a young person, what do you read? I don't really read very much. I'm sorry. That's a ticket. The first step is to learn the language, how the language is used. Learn the beauty in the language. Learn the language as a tool. And that, for me, that it's not an effort. I love to read. You can't stop me. And I think, I've actually had people tell me that Nickel and Dimed was the first book they finished. And I didn't know how to feel about that. I mean, on one hand, really proud. On the other hand, terrible. Just terrible. I mean...
Well, earlier we heard this wonderful blurb of Nickel and Dimed from a friend who said it was the most depressing book she could never put down.
It's not depressing. Yeah.
But one thing that, and this is not a paid commercial, I think that characterizes her writing is this remarkable fluency and terseness as well. There's much in little. There's not this endless verbosity and run-on sentences that begin in Tampa and end in Tucson. You're right on the mark. And I was wondering if your scientific background may have given you that sense of precision.
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised. Great way to learn to write. Write some science, your dissertation, your theory. Anybody ever done that kind of writing? All passive voice. But as a discipline, it's good because you just absolutely have to focus on the points you want, on what you're trying to say. And I always, say that when I've taught journalism essay writing classes or something is, Don't worry about saying things in lovely ways and, what adjectives and adverbs you're going to use. The first thing is to have something to say. That's where the struggle is. I mean, I don't find writing sentences down too difficult, probably from those years and years of reading, but the struggle, the agony, the waking up in the middle of the night, that's the thing. What exactly do I have to say, needs to be said, that hasn't been said? And how can I make that clear?
And you invest it with the passion. There's energy there.
Well, can't help that. It just infects everything.
Well, it may be, growing up in Butte, Montana, which you say was still a bustling, brawling, blue-collar mining town. Your father was a miner. Other men in your family were either miners or railroad workers. And today, Butte, you note, is sadly an underpopulated, woefully polluted EPA Superfund site, thanks to the mining companies.
Yeah, I mean, it's a story like so many others that... the mining companies come in or the lumber companies or whatever it is, and they make their money and they go off. And when the Anaconda Company left Butte, Montana to go get their copper from Chile, they They didn't bother pumping out the mines. They let the mines flood. They let all those toxic chemical wastes flood the city. Neighborhoods are buried underwater that is so toxic that, you know, the birds have been seen accidentally going into it and disappearing.
What was your take on the Occupy movement?
Oh, I loved it. Anybody here from Occupy Santa Fe? Well, congratulations. Thank you. And, you know, I think that actually that was a turning point in which we began to understand a lot of that, that criminalization of poverty, and while that it's illegal to be homeless, that it is illegal to do things outdoors in public, that biologically you have to do, and there's no provision for. It was a turning point for me. I mean, I remember going to Zuccotti Park in New York City and to visit. You know, I'm too old to stay overnight, and that's my excuse anyway.
And it's a very small park, incidentally. It's not like Central Park.
No, Zuccotti's
like
pretty small.
Yeah,
but so I go there, and I'm, you know, enjoying it, and it's so much that's going on. And then I started thinking, where do you pee? And there was one Starbucks about three blocks away, which would let people use their bathrooms. And there was a block-long line outside for that. There are no public facilities. And I a lot of things, I think, were brought home to a lot of us who were not homeless through the Occupy encampments. And I think in that way, it was sort of a brilliant tactic, although it's not a tactic that was easy to continue.
Urination is a problem in America, clearly.
It's a right, I say.
And Occupy, to some extent, did inject the 1% versus 99%, and income inequality became, and wealth inequality
yes.
became part of the political discourse. But except for a recent revival after the superstorm Sandy hit the New York, New Jersey area, where Occupy people helped people in distress, get them out of their homes, et cetera, and feed them, the movement's pretty much seems to have dissipated.
Well, I don't think it's as visible, but one of the things that Occupy people are working on, maybe also here in Santa Fe, but I think nationally, is one thing I mentioned when I was in my talk is abolishing debt. We have to, and I'm not talking about for the big banks, but we have to look at this $1 trillion now in student loan debt. I don't know what the number is on medical debt, but medical debt, you know, as Elizabeth Warren pointed out before she became a senator, the number one cause of bankruptcy in the United States. And I think that the Occupy demand is worth pushing for. Abolish these debts and let people live.
And there was the Occupy slogan, of course, of we got sold out, they got bailed out.
Yeah.
It kind mm-hmm. of encapsulated the mm-hmm. the politics of the era. You've said that we've got to move the discussion from what can we do for the poor to what do we have to stop doing to the poor. Can you talk more about that?
Well, I think the liberal idea is generally, you know, is a good one. How do we put these things together? Housing and good jobs and education and make all that work for people. I'm completely down with that. But at the same, we have to not look away from the huge levels of incarceration in this country, from the needless, you know, the insanity, for example, of the war on drugs, which has resulted in the incarceration of so many African-American men, and these other forms of the criminalization of poverty that are going on.
Michelle Alexander, again, from this stage, spoke eloquently about that.
She's talking about Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow.
Tell me more, what's coming up for the Economic Hardship Reporting Project? It's a bit hard to say that.
I know.
E-H-R-P.
And it's even worse to abbreviate. The acronym is ERP.
ERP.
but, you know, well, we have some very hot things in the works right now, today. Go to CNN.com, and you will see something we got Susan Faludi, the well-known feminist, to write about Sheryl Sandberg's intervention in feminism. And the, you know, Sheryl Sandberg, the Yahoo executive who's written a book called Lean In, for about how women can get ahead, essentially, in the corporate hierarchy. Unfortunately, that book came out at the same time as the female CEO of Yahoo stopped the possibility of working from home. Very, very important for parents of both sexes, but particularly women, while she built her own nursery next to her office at the Yahoo building. Now, I say I'm not really interested in women making it up the corporate ladder if they're not going to get to the top and have that minimal level of concern for their women employees.
Your views on women in combat?
Fine. No, I mean, and I've been saying this for a long time. One of my books you didn't mention is about war. Nobody, my favorite of my own books is called Blood Rights.
Yeah, it's a terrific book.
Nobody mentions it, but because it's scholarly, in my own form of scholarly. But I, you know, the point is that ever since the introduction of action at a distance weapons, like bows and arrows, strength, upper body strength, has not been the determining thing in inability to fight. That's nonsense. Now, the other thing is, when you're using action at the distance weapons, and our most common one for the last few hundred years has been guns, you don't want to be in some kind of testosterone rage when you're taking aim. Rage and the total sort of testosterone story of war, silly. Where you got to be now is, you know, unless you're fighting, you know, hand to hand and wrestling or something. So, you know, women, we can do it too. And any guy here who questions that and thinks that women aren't capable of being really aggressive, I'll meet you outside.
I'm not going to top that. So that's a perfect place to stop. And she will meet you outside in the lobby signing her books. Barbara Aronoy.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Heaney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.